Now, rather meteorology, I did not show you a slideshow of that. That is available on the CD if you're interested in getting it, called Elements of Grade 8. There's a lot of meteorology work there. And as I said, we worked a great deal with storms and currents. And the main thing in meteorology is for students to understand the way in which water and air interact. That's basically what it's all about, which is another way of saying meteorology is helping the students understand how their etheric body, which is connected with the entire watery hydrosphere of the Earth, and their astral body, which is connected with the atmosphere, the part of around our Earth that breathes, how the etheric and the astral are interacting, and how storms can actually be a salvation. They're like a safety valve. If great storms like hurricanes didn't occur every autumn in the Northern Hemisphere, then there would be far more disastrous weather events going on in Asia in the spring, and much worse things going on in the Southern Hemisphere in the winter. So this is something good for them to understand, the necessity of storms. And of course, nowadays, as the issue of global warming and climatic changes comes up, there'll be a lot that they'll want to talk about, and you know, a lot of good food for thought in the discussion. Organic chemistry, I show you that as well. I'm sorry the slideshow is kind of short, but at least I think if you, you know, read their lab reports that are there, if you pause the video and look at the illustration, I think you'll see what we covered there. And a big thing that we did was that history of sugar and talking about sweeteners and sugars, because I think, of course, that's a huge issue today for adolescents. There were certainly a number of kids in my class who were addicted to sugar, candy, and things like that. Very, very, very big. So I felt that that was really helpful for them to work with. We also looked, I don't have it in the book, but we did discuss also alkaloids, plant poisons, and how they're found in drugs and things like that. We did have some discussion about alcohol, tobacco, drugs, that also arose out of the organic chemistry work as well. Then we went on to the second part of history, which is this great revolutionary time, with particularly the American Revolution and the French Revolution, very, very much at the center of this. Now, at this time, we also started to read a book by Jacques Lucerne called And There Was Light. And some of you may be quite familiar with this book. It's about a young Frenchman who was born with sight, and then as a result of an accident at age 9, lost his sight and became then blind. And it's the story of how he overcame this handicap and was able to lead basically a perfectly normal life, even a reckless life in many respects. Very exciting, very, very beautiful, evocative stories of his adolescence. But then he is drawn into occupied France. He's living in France during World War II. And suddenly he's in a country that's occupied by the Nazis in Paris. And here he becomes part of the French resistance. And he's a valuable part of the French resistance, not in spite of his blindness, but because of his blindness, because his blindness has given him a kind of second sight. And he is able to clairvoyantly be able to listen to a person's voice and be in that person's presence and determine if this person can be trusted or not, if this person can join the resistance or may be sent there as a spy, as some kind of double agent. And finally, then he ends up in concentration camps. He goes through the most horrendous experiences, he and his friends, and we hear about what they went through as well. It's very, very powerful. In this one book, you basically get a tremendous slice of history of the mid-20th century, and you get a huge picture then of figures like Winston Churchill, Stalin, Hitler. You know, you can draw on his words about them, and you can fill in some of the blanks there. So it's a wonderful way, if you don't have the time to go into the 20th century with your class. If your school has a Waldorf high school, the high school teachers may not want you to go into the 20th century. But this way you can take a step into it. Kelly had asked about the Diary of Anne Frank and whether and how one brings the Holocaust to students. And I would say that Jacques Lucerne's book is a good step into this. There's another book called, I think it's called Count the Stars, which was a Newbery. For me? What is it called?
Oh, Number the Stars.
Number the Stars. So this is a well-written book. I think it was a Newbery Award-winning book, also about Scandinavian children getting involved with issues in the Holocaust. There are more books written about it these days for young people. The Diary of Anne Frank, yes, it can be brought to a very mature eighth grade. In Green Meadow, I actually taught it in the high school at a 10th grade level, and I felt they could really get it. I'm not sure my eighth graders would have been able to get all the ramifications of what was going on, but it's a very, very powerful book. It, too, has been turned into a play. It's good, of course, for a small cast. It only has a few characters because everybody's already in hiding. But once again, I would say I would look at that play carefully and use it judiciously because it's a little bit powerful for eighth graders. So definitely the Holocaust can be mentioned and discussed a bit. But also I think you just have to say, you know, a lot of the issues in that Holocaust, you're better off asking about it when you're in high school. And, you know, it'll be a different matter then. And so it's a little intense for eighth graders to get that close, or all the other genocides in the 20th century. Certainly that was not the only one. You know, Stalin killed many more people who weren't even his enemies. They were his own people. They were Russians. They were people in the Soviet Union. So we have any number of stories of, you know, Holocausts going on in that century. So that's some of the history, you know, to certainly to try to go up to the 19th century. You can go as far as the Civil War in the United States, Margarita and Dorita. You'll have to find, you know, your own equivalents, of course, in Mexican and Canadian history for that, and maybe touch a little bit into the beginnings of the 20th century. Physics, this differs so much from school to school. In my school, the tradition was you always did electricity and magnetism in eighth grade. In other schools, you work much more with a variety of all branches of physics in sixth and seventh and eighth grade. So you're always working with electricity, magnetism, heat, hydraulics, acoustics, whatever, every grade. I would say there, Roberto Trusci's book on physics is fun, is very, very helpful in terms of, you know, giving you some structure for that. But once again, I would say the important thing is that the students are observing what's going on, writing about it carefully, drawing the phenomena that they've seen as well as they can, because one of the reasons we teach physics and laboratory science all together at this age is to help them come out of themselves, to help them find their way out of their exclusive interest in their own being and give them a chance to go out into the world around them and really observe things carefully. Now, let me say something about the question that was asked a little while ago about the children drawing and the quality of the drawings. Okay, so you've seen these slideshows, and of course, any teacher doing something like this is going to want to show you work done on a very high level, you know, that these are the best students. Yes, some of the work that you see there is done by students who have always been good at drawing. However, I would say in some of those slideshows, one-third to one-half of the work that you're looking at was done by students who only got good at drawing in grade 6 or grade 7 or even only in grade 8. And this is how I work with drawing from grade 1 or when I took a class on, like my last class in grade 4. What I did was to see who was drawing well. For, you know, who was it for whom drawing just came naturally? Okay. Usually students like that not only draw beautifully, they also are fast. They do things well, and then they sit there, can I read a book or can I go out or something like that? And my answer to them was, yes, you can do some reading, but first, for the next 10 minutes, I want you to go over to where Chris and Tim are sitting because they're struggling with that drawing, and I'd like you to help them. Show them how to get started. You can even start doing the drawing in their book and then let them finish it, you know, based on what you've begun there. I made sure that any student who was good in any subject, whether it was drawing, writing, mathematics, physics, chemistry, whatever, that they also became my assistant teacher and that they went on and would work with one or two or three, sometimes even a group of four other kids, and give them hints and show them how they did what they did. Because at this age in particular, by eighth grade, the students are going to learn much more from one another than they will from you. They're very peer-oriented. They will do anything for their best friend. If their best friend says, sit there and draw Napoleon beautifully, they will sit there and draw Napoleon beautifully. And you can threaten and beg and beat them over the head or whatever. They're not going to do it for you. But if their friends are involved, if a client is involved, this is very powerful. This is also a wonderful thing because certainly when it comes to drawing, generally, the girls are years ahead of the boys. Same with writing. There are exceptions. But generally, the girls are 3, 5, even 7 years ahead of the boys in their capacities. So the girls become the boys' tutors and teachers. And this really helps to contain some of the, you know, oafishness and sexist and whatever stuff that boys are prone to at this age. That they really develop a kind of respect for the girls because the girls are constantly helping them out of jams and showing them a technique for drawing a horse or how they figured out the way to draw drapery so it looks like it's really folded and shadowed and so on. And this, in this way, over time, and unfortunately you don't have all the time that, you know, you might have had, over time, you raise the level of the class so that what you saw in those slideshows, two-thirds of my students, about 21 out of 32 students, could draw that way, what you see there. It's not just the two or three brightest and the two or three, you know, natural-born artists. It's rather that you start to, as they say, the rising tide raises all the boats. And that's what happens, that as these stronger students in one subject or another act like leavening, and they start to raise the level of everybody in the class. The girls can also help wonderfully with writing. They really help the boys become better at writing and more enthusiastic about it. The boys, on the other hand, really help the girls overcome their fear of things exploding in chemistry, or they help the girls observe and articulate what went on in a physics demonstration, whereas many of the girls might not be able to do that. So they get the girls much more interested in science than the girls might ordinarily be. It's a wonderful synergy. And even though you only have a few months left of school, I would say give that a try. You know, let your students be your teachers. Each one teach one, as we say. That will be a very powerful force, not only in raising the level of the class artistically and academically, but also in creating more of a social cohesion. So it's one of these areas where we don't have to take the kids on a rope course to teach them how to be social beings. You know, we don't have to tell them, jump backwards and blindfolded off that cliff and know that your classmates will catch you. Trust them. We don't have to do that. We can get them to work with one another in the main lesson with the subjects we have, and we can build trust and we can build social cohesion without having to spend thousands of dollars taking them off to some kind of, you know, high-tech ropes course or something. Not that I'm opposed to those, not that those aren't nice, but I'm just saying I think we undersell ourselves, that we kind of buy into this idea that school is one thing, but really learning to be social, really learning to trust, really learning to have courage is something else. No, these two things are very connected. And as I mentioned also when I showed you in the slideshow, the debate over the Copernican and Ptolemaic worldview and the way the students had to present in their compositions graphically as well as verbally, they had to present what the issue was and what the argument was. There were students in my class, eighth graders, mostly girls, but a couple of boys as well, who were crying. They had tears of frustration welling from their eyes because they could not figure it out. They could not understand what Copernicus was proving. They could not understand what Ptolemy meant by epicycles and how that explained anything. They had to develop then the higher degree of frustration level. You know, they had to raise their tolerance for being frustrated. They had to develop courage and persistence to keep working at it and working at it. And they did this with the help of their friends who came over and said, no, 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 you know, explain to me. Tell me why you don't understand it, and I'll help you figure it out. That is an inner ropes course. Ropes course, helmets or braces or anything, but that is crossing over a big gap, having the courage to be suspended in the cosmos and not knowing where you're going to turn and getting kind of inwardly dizzy and then being able to understand it and get yourself out of that labyrinth. That's a very, very powerful experience for the students. Okay, we've spoken about class play, world geography. I didn't show you what we did in geography, though there again, some of that is on the eighth grade CD. I would say that the way in which I did geography, even 7 years ago, I think, thank goodness, is becoming old-fashioned and that it's getting supplanted by a much better way of teaching geography. And the better way is that even starting in grade 5, teachers are beginning to work more with geographical systems and geographical commonalities. That is to say that 1 year, you might teach about people all over the world who live in mountains, mountainous areas. Another year you teach about people all over the world who live among rivers or on the ocean. Another year you teach about the people on plateaus and on the plains. I think that really we are heading towards a revolution in the way that geography is taught in Waldorf schools, and it's going to be more and more that every year after they've learned local geography, it's going to be world geography, grades 5 through 8. So I would say that's something to think about. Now, of course, whether you were the teacher or not, probably they already learned it the older way. So the conventional way of doing it, which I think will disappear over the next 7 or 10 years, is that in eighth grade, you teach everything you never taught before. So probably you're going to teach about Asian geography and the geography of Pacifica, of Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, maybe the geography of Russia as well, and anything else you'd get to. Really vast. It's really gigantic. It's very, very hard to do much justice to it. So in my last, with my last group, I focused on China. I didn't do a whole lot with Russia or Asia. In other years, in Japan, other years I have done much more with Russia. But I felt, well, China is becoming a growing social force, and it's, you know, what goes on there is affecting us more and more deeply. So that seemed to be the right way to go. But I would say that that's old hat. And I would not recommend what I did to you if you can possibly work in a more comprehensive way. Okay, so let me stop there. And hope from this, you know, questions, comments about all that I've brought in the last hour and a half or so. Please don't hesitate. It looks like Megan has something.
Hi, Eugene.
Hi, Megan.
I had emailed, but maybe you didn't get it to ask, even though unrelated about what you just were speaking of. When I went to the January conference here at Steiner College, in January, the public school conference, there was a great deal from UN Rainbow about current events and debate in the upper grades. And I began bringing that in seventh grade and really found it to be just an inspiring course for my students as kind of an extra main offering for them. And with the pending, with the coming election, I was curious as any advice you could give. Our eighth grade students went through the historical time of Obama being elected, and now we have
turn.
And my impulse is to lead my eighth grade through somewhat of a mock election and really have them debate and talk before the election. I mean, I'm not sure how exposed my kids will be to all of it in the media, but I really think there's an opportunity here for these students because this will be the last election that they will not vote in.
So isn't that incredible?
Yeah, I was wondering
what
if you
an incredible thought. Yeah.
Do you have any indications that way? Because I've been leading my kids in this way already. So much so that in fourth grade, our students watched the inauguration, but I chose not to let my fourth graders watch it because I just didn't think it was a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to bring it to them as eighth graders, full-fledged and, you know, unabridged.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Two out of the four eighth grades that I had took place during elections. One of them was way back in the Ronald Reagan days, and another then was George Bush and Al Gore. So that was another pretty powerful time. And I would agree with you, as much, you know, time and energy as you have to really bring them into that whole hog, because especially if they're going to be doing this in, in the future when they're older, they're not going to ever have anybody with the objectivity that you're going to be able to bring to this, to really help them not just argue and say what they heard their father saying the night before about this one being an idiot and that one being a socialist or whatever, but that they really are able to start to, you know, understand these things are complicated and there are many shades of gray here and there. What we did was, number one, we would take an issue that was covered in the New York Times. So I would bring in the New York Times. I would, you know, Xerox how it was written about in the New York Times. I would bring in the New York Post, a newspaper which is known to many people, even outside of New York, you know, one of the real tabloids of America, show how the article was treated there. And then the students also had the assignment to watch the evening news and to see how it was taken up on the news. And then we would talk about that, different ways of presenting it. So it wasn't only about the election. It was also about media. And it was also about, you know, journalism. And we even looked at the grammar. Were there any direct quotes? You hardly see those anymore. Very, very rarely do you see a direct quote in newspapers. Nobody wants to be held responsible for that. Were there lots of passive voice issues? You know, mistakes were made, the president said.
Welcome, Eugene.
Hi, I'm sorry, everybody. I got cut off, but I'm back. So we were talking about the media. See, the media is getting back at me for talking about it. Cuts me off. But anyway, you know, this is a time where, once again, you're going to see a lot of interesting things. That kids will come in the morning, as I said, calling one or the other candidate names, you know, really insulting things. And you think that they're saying this. You realize they heard their dad. Usually it's the father who says this. They heard their dad saying it the night before. They may have argued with him at dinner time about that. But the next morning they come back quoting him. You realize how deeply connected kids are with their fathers at this age. And it's good if you, in one of your early parent evenings, warn the parents about this matter, that they have to be very, very careful that their kids' astral bodies pick this stuff up and they don't know how to process it. You know, they just come in with these blanket statements, and then you as the teacher have to try to bring balance and moderation and rationality and so on. So the parents have to realize that, you know, you're going to know their opinions about every candidate and who they're voting for, because their kids are going to come in like reflecting apparatuses. The debate is terrific, Megan, because in debating them, they learn how to be polite, how to listen to your opponent, how to take his arguments or her arguments and turn them around, as, of course, you experienced Rainbow and I doing that with tremendous politeness towards each other and things like that. So anyway, that's, you know, it's a terrific thing to do. We also then got together. We went to the high school where there was a big screen television, because all the high school teachers liked to watch football games together when the students weren't there. So they had a great TV set there, and we all watched the debate. We only watched one of them because the students weren't interested in seeing any more. They found it so boring. They found that the candidate, they said, that's not really a debate. They're not taking each other's arguments and turning them around. You know, they're so dull. There's no, you know, he's not really, he could have said this or that. It was very interesting how discriminating they were already and discerning about what a debate was. But it was very exciting for them that, you know, the class teacher was there in the room. We're all watching television together. And having this experience, this commonality. Now, nowadays, that so much more is also on the internet. Now, maybe they should have the assignment of going on Mitt Romney's website and following an issue or two, and going on Obama's website and following an issue or two. I'm sure there are different ways now that one could work with that and you know, just to be able to compare and see what each is conveniently leaving out, where there might be exaggerations or distortions of what the other one said or did. I think all of that can be of great value. So thank you for bringing this up, because I, you know, I forgot to talk about current events. And as you say, it's a very important part of this year. Well, with any, so is that helpful, Megan?
Yes, thank you. I've already integrated it as a weekly course for my class. We won't go political until about October. But I really was actually considering having them take the opposite side of what they believe in, and to work through that, to be convincing and to work through the policies and beliefs of the other side.
Very, very good. Very good. And that goes along with Steiner's idea that, you know, it's really good for the eighth grader to be able to address two sides of an issue, mm-hmm. be it historical or current, and be able to speak intelligently and objectively either way. That's wonderful. And I think I'm going to be visiting your school in November, so I look forward to
great.
If I come, it will be, I think it's Wednesday, the day after Election Day, Megan.
Oh, wow.
So that should be really interesting, really interesting.
Yeah, I was looking at November, I think it was second, the first week of November, to do a student debate, to have it, you know, do a kind of a public forum debate, which would be fun.
Wonderful. We also, something else we did was students went around, because again, we had a high school, they went to grades 6, 7, and then grades 9 through 12, and they asked just for hands to be raised, mm-hmm. you know, if you could vote.
Mm-hmm.
For whom would you vote? And then we made charts and graphs about that. And they did correlation, you know, gender correlation, and I forget, you know, who liked mm-hmm. chocolate and vanilla ice cream and who voted Republican or Democratic, whatever it was. So they had these wonderful different kinds of graphs and charts about it. So it worked into mathematics as well.
Very cool. Yeah.
That's a
okay.
good idea.
Thank you. Good. Anyone else with a comment, question, suggestion?
Eugene, I had something else to, I guess, ask / say about the debate and election teaching. This is Teresa.
Sure.
I was just, I guess, one of the things I've been contemplating was starting the year with the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and then from there maybe extending the block a couple weeks to do part of the main lesson block and have that be about current events and presidential elections and the branches of government. What do you think about that?
I think that would be good, though. I would just warn you, you don't want to spend, the only thing I would ever spend more than 3 weeks on was a physics block, because those demonstrations need to be repeated so much that, you know, things can go a little bit slowly. Just be careful about, even if there's tremendous enthusiasm for a subject, after three and a half weeks, the students may just, you know, be craving something else. It's like, again,
okay.
they're breathing. So you may not want to continue it in that way, but maybe making it part of extra main, or maybe coming back to it when you're doing another block.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the branches of government, you know, rising out of the American Revolution is great, and also for them to see, you know, when George Washington was president or Jefferson was president, the presidency was a much more modest sort of position. You know, he was just really a citizen among others, and it the kind of grandiosity of the presidency
mm-hmm.
is very much a 20th century matter. It was hardly there in the 19th century. So that's kind of good to bring to them, that the change, that, you know, now the presidency is essentially a monarchy in our country. He's I was in Prague last year, and there you have what's called the Prague Castle, which is now, it was where the, you know, emperor used to be. Now it's where the president of Czech Republic is. And there was a huge state event going on with the heads of states and ambassadors and bishops and so on. They were all invited to this gigantic gala in the presidential palace, okay? we could get within about 10 feet of that palace. We could just, with any other group of tourists, just walk right up. You could see the people there on the steps smoking, you know, getting out of the crowded party and smoking on the steps. Almost no security whatsoever in a country that had a monarchy up until very recently. And I had just been at the White House not much longer before that. And, you know, you can't get within a million feet of that place. It's, you get closer to Buckingham Palace in London, to closer to the Queen, than you do to the president. That's the kind of country we're living in now, and that's a little scary, I think. But anyway, so that would be good to make it a continuation of U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like we have a younger, a member of the younger generation among us.
Sorry, that's my daughter.
Oh, that's okay. That's very nice. Nice to hear a child's voice back there.
Well, Eugene, I wanted to share, I have chosen to do Into the Woods, the musical, with my class.
Because of the fairy tale.
It is.
Well,
yeah, and it's just a wonderful piece and very challenging musically. But I just wanted to offer that there are a series of Broadway Junior versions of regular Broadway shows that have been taken down to an eighth grade level. So even though musicals are lofty, there's a vast selection that have actually been transitioned to junior versions for middle schools.
And do you have a website for that or an address to get those?
I believe it's MTI is the company's name, MTI. They are in New York. I've actually already ordered the rights for our production in March.
Much did that cost you?
Actually, it's close to $800 for the rights to do the production.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But I was fundraising last year, so I'm already sitting pretty for that.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Thought about doing that with all the plays that I've written, which keep getting produced. I'd be a millionaire by now.
You would.
Amazing, yeah. But, you know, if you want that kind of production and you want to do it on that level, yeah, you're dealing with a living composer, a living librettist, and so on, and it's their right to get that kind of remuneration. But it'll be interesting. I mean, Stephen Sondheim, his music is super sophisticated, so good for you. More power to you to work something like that.
Well, they even take the music down a few notches so that it's kind of, they give you a recorded CD, but I'm going to have my students be the orchestra because there's only 20 parts in the play, and I'm carrying 27 students. So I'm going to have both parents and students join in an orchestra for our production.
That sounds wonderful. Okay, very good. You know what would be great? I'm going to be able, a lot of you said yes to sharing your information. So what I'm going to do when the conference is over, I'm going to, distribute emails and things like that. And I hope that you guys stay in touch with one another, you know, that maybe you can have photographs or even a video. I'm sure some parents are going to want to video this musical so that other people can see it. And, you know, get an idea, even if not for this time around, but for what is possible in eighth grade. There's not much literature, there's not much record in the Waldorf movement altogether of what an eighth grade play can look like. Mm-hmm. And that would be one. That's why I shared those costumes with you, you know, that my students did for A Midsummer Night's Dream. Eighth graders can do incredible things. If they're given the time and, you know, the help, it's that they love it. They really love getting into every aspect of the play. I also had a parent who was a trained lighting person. She had done lighting on off-Broadway plays in New York. And she worked with my boys, a group of boys who didn't ever want to be on stage. Sometimes they had to be. But they did lighting with her from fourth grade on. By eighth grade, they were doing algebraic equations to figure out how to distribute one or another color on the stage. They were going into the high school and doing lighting for the high school plays because she trained them so well. So that sort of thing is really wonderful if that's possible to do.
Eugene, this is Margarita.
Yes.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Margarita.
It's about writing and artistic writing and grammar.
Yes, that's right.
How do you fit it into the curriculum? Is it in extra main or only during the different epochs, or what do you do?
Yes, okay. So we call the epochs blocks. Yeah, you'll notice that in what I read to you, I had no one place there that was grammar, writing, or anything like that. Because this, like mental arithmetic, it was some weeks it was twice a week, sometimes it was three times a week. I would write some sentences on the board. Often they were sentences taken from student compositions. Sometimes they were sentences that I had photocopied from a great writer who might be writing about a subject they were studying, like Lawrence van der Post writing about Africa, or Will Durant writing about the French Revolution. So I would write some sentences on the board, and then we would look at them from different points of view. You know, are these compound sentences, complex sentences? Are there lots of independent clauses, subordinate clauses? Or another time we would talk about the way adjectives were used, or adverbs, or verbs, or nouns, or, you know, what was the nominative? What was the predicate? So we were constantly, in small doses, working with grammar through the year. We didn't introduce a whole lot of new things. By the end of seventh grade, I pretty much covered what the students needed to do, even going into, you know, grammatical moods like the subjunctive and things like that. So they were really ready now to start applying it, and we worked much more with style. And I used this wonderful book by Strunk and White, the classic English language grammar book called Elements of Style, which is a very, very great book. And then I sent you all a link on the website to those articles in the New York Times by the woman Catherine Hale, I think her name is, which are also very much about style and working with the structure of the sentence. That sort of thing, these finer points, are very good. In terms of getting students to write better, I would say you have to assume that half of your boys are not going to be writing much of anything really decent until they're in 11th grade. Most boys do not develop their own voice in writing or interest in writing or love of writing or anything of writing until they're in 11th grade. You know, you push as hard as you can, you help them out, but they're going to be writing the simplest sentences they can, believing that way they make fewer mistakes, and they'll use as few adjectives and adverbs as they can because they're still not sure what the difference is and they don't want to get them confused. You know, they're doing anything they can to make it easy for themselves, and that means horrible writing. But I would say you want to get the other half of the boys, or even the other two-thirds of the boys, to be coming to enjoy writing and to feel that they can express themselves. The girls, for the most part, will take care of themselves. You know, if one girl is writing well and discovers a creative, humorous way to write, five other girls will try to do the same thing, and that will help them write better. And then 10 other girls see what they're doing, and they get excited about it. So the girls, kind of just out of their natural competitiveness and their wish to conform at this age, their writing is not that hard to keep improving and working with. It's the boys, you know, with whom you really want to work the hardest. I didn't do there are some schools of thought that when the children write something, they should be writing three or four drafts, you know, and one draft gets handed out to their classmates who comment on it and correct it. And then another draft goes to you, and another draft, I don't know, goes to somewhere else. I think that's, you know, we're not university creative writing courses. We're still teaching eighth graders. They're still kids. I would have them write one rough draft. That would come to me usually on Friday morning. I would read some of those aloud, or they would read some of those aloud even before they were corrected. And then I would take them home. I would not write any corrections in. I would just circle things and say, you know, this shouldn't be a subordinate clause or punctuation or spelling. But they'd have to do the work, and they'd have to really, you know, mine their knowledge of grammar or get help from other students in how to correct that. And then the next week, they would write that composition into their book. Now, you've seen examples of some of their compositions. Obviously, some of these things could take 3 or 4 main lessons just to copy from the rough draft. So as I said in one of the slideshows, my students would only have fairly short main lesson books with perhaps 2 or maybe 3 compositions that they wrote in history, let's say, or geography. Science, there were more because they were writing very short lab reports. But where they were doing things that were more more narrative and less expository, more creative, I gave them a lot of time to work on that sort of thing. And you know, and I think they used that time well. And particularly the girls, though, half of the things I showed you in those books were written by boys as well. Now, there will be boys who really rise to the occasion and write better. So the grammar was very practical. It was just constantly reviewing, showing them the finer points of grammar, and also showing them issues where there's no clear answer, where a word could be really either an adverb or an adjective, or where we could say that that is an independent clause, but from another point of view, it could be subordinate, or it could be adverbial or adjectival. So, you know, I think the main thing is, if your class has had a lot of grammar, then you can work that way. If they have not had a lot of grammar, if their grammar is weak, you want this year to be the year where it shines. But one suggestion I have, if you're going to do a grammar block, always do it after they've studied anatomy. Because when they've studied anatomy, something arises within them out of that skeleton that allows them to penetrate the skeleton of the language. And they somehow in eighth grade, a sudden flash of enthusiasm arises in relationship to grammar that generally was not there in earlier grades. You have to be very patient with that subject. And you have to be sure, how's your grammar? Are you speaking well to the children? Are you a model of clear, good speech? You know, and not just falling into slang and not slurring your words, because they're probably not getting very good grammar from their parents. They're certainly not getting very good grammar from the media, from advertising, from their friends, from texting, whatever. You're the only one. You're the last thing that they've got that may represent the English or the Spanish tongue in the way that it really should be. So that's a huge responsibility that we have in this eighth grade. It may be the last time, unless they go to a Waldorf school and have a Waldorf English teacher, the last time where they're really going to hear their language spoken well.
Eugene, I have a follow-up question when it's the right time.
Okay, well, unless somebody else has a question, you can go ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay, it's Helen. So on the correcting work that you do, so when they've done their draft and they've corrected it and they put it into their main lesson book.
Yes.
my situation with a number of my boys is that that process is done so haphazardly that their main lesson page continues to be filled with errors. And it would looking over their work 4 or 5 or 6 different times of the same draft in order to have a correct. So how do you deal with that? Do you, up to this point, I've been making them even redo some pages if there's a, you know.
Yes. No, I would definitely do that. Now, I'd say by 8th grade, I didn't have much of a problem with that anymore. But definitely in grade 5, grade 6, grade 7, yes. If a lot of mistakes were still there in the second draft, they'd have to do a third draft. You know, that definitely. I'm just saying my hope was, you know, it wasn't my method to do draft upon draft. But if they're not getting it and they're still doing things in a pretty sloppy way, they would have to do it over. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to change the subject.
Well, I was just going to say, I also had an odd issue, the opposite issue. I had a number of students whose first drafts were virtually perfect. Grammatically, punctuation, spelling. There were even, you know, 5 pages tightly written, small writing. They made almost no mistakes. So, of course, I knew with those students, I could just zip through their composition and not read it even that carefully and write at the end, you know, excellent, wonderfully done, this can go in your main lesson book. So what they started to do was purposely make mistakes to catch me and see if I was reading their work carefully enough. And when I didn't catch a mistake, they would write on the blackboard, "Mr. Schwartz missed the following mistakes in Jessica's composition." And they'd write on top of it, "Do not erase," because they wanted the specialist teachers to see it when they came in the classroom. So I had to really, you know, eat humble pie, as we say, in that. But go ahead. You had another question, Kelly.
I do. Often at our school, we have a high school humanities teacher come in and teach an 8th grade block of short stories.
Right.
And I'm just looking at the amount to cover in 8th grade, and I'm wondering if the precious time be given to that, is that an important element of 8th grade?
I would say no. I think that in 7th grade, you know, the creative writing work that's done there, I don't think that is meant to be something that then you kind of keep continuing. Well, what do we do for creative writing in grade 8 and grade 9 and so on? It's something in a way, it's like you're throwing a little bit of steak to the dragon of the astral body and allowing that creativity, which is very, very bound up with their sexual creativity, with their ability to recreate, reproduce their own kind out of their own organism, you in a way satisfy that need, and then you let that rest for a while. Some of it is definitely going to come back in the compositions that they write. You could see like the one about Galileo in that book I have, in which the student is really writing a bit of a historical novel there, you know, not just sticking to my facts, but also trying to make it more creative. That's fine. I don't know that 8th graders are ready to write short stories. The short story is one of the most difficult of all artistic forms. You know, the people who write great short stories are the great masters of writing, James Joyce and Leo Tolstoy and Isaac Bashevis Singer. A lot of good novelists can't write good short stories. They're that hard. So I don't think that's necessary. If the high school wants an excuse to come in and clean up your act, Kelly, because you don't know what you're doing, they should just let you know that, you know, and not put it under the pretext of teaching the kids to be creative writers. That can easily wait till 9th or 10th grade. I don't think there's anything sacrificed there if that's waited for. If the teacher wants to come in and do anything, I would say let that teacher take short story writers and analyze their style and show the way in which, an adjective here, an adverb there, foreshadows what's going to come a few pages down the line, or how the terse writing of a great short story writer with no extra words and no unnecessary phrases, how that really allows everything to be compacted and so on. I think that kind of analysis would be better than asking the kids to write something themselves. Some of them will rise to the occasion and do well, but many of them, it's just, it's really forcing it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Eugene, this is Teresa. Can I bounce a follow-up question off what Kelly asked?
Yeah. Certainly.
So I was thinking the same thing as she was about doing short story, and I had kind of come to that conclusion that you did about, finding short stories that maybe, there are plenty that connect with the American history curriculum, for example, and using those in extra mains. I was just wondering what other recommendations you might have for, language arts, for novels or short stories or other, more
yes.
reading instead
yes.
of writing, things
right.
that you can do with the kids.
Yeah. Well, I would very strongly suggest Leo Tolstoy. And I'd say some of the great stories that eighth graders just really, really love, that I've had very positive experiences with, were Tolstoy's story, Ivan the Fool, and mm-hmm. also What Men Live By.
Hello.
And then Tolstoy, so those are longer stories. Ivan the Fool is quite long. What Men Live By, that's going to be several readings that you'll need. But he also wrote stories which are very often out of print. They're not always easy to get, though I have some of them as an ebook that I have on my iPhone. Fairy tales that he wrote for the children of the serfs on his estate when he was teaching them. These are stories that are sometimes one or two paragraphs long. They are such masterpieces of brevity and incredible profundity. They range from one paragraph to maybe 20 paragraphs long. There are very few of them are longer than 3 pages. And those are wonderful because they really show, how a master can take hold of this narrative. On the other hand, however, of course, Tolstoy is not writing in English or in Spanish. And I think, you also want to give them examples of masters from their own language who really are able to, convey things in a very powerful and very strong way. And unfortunately, in English language short stories, most of these short stories that are classics of the English language were written for magazines in the 20th century, and they're usually far too sophisticated, far too mature, far too dark for eighth graders. One that I would suggest is O. Henry, who's looked at, as kind of a light wave in writing. But his stories are wonderful, and they also, just are filled with humor and irony and these different soul states in a way, and wish and wonder and surprise. His stories definitely have that quality. So I would suggest, he'd be a very good writer in the English language, very good stylist, and, not a great writer, but certainly for an eighth grade level, his would be very good to take up.
Any suggestions for poetry or for novels that the class reads?
Novels that I did with my class that were most successful were The Education of Little Tree,
mm-hmm.
even though its author, Forrest Carter, has become a terribly controversial individual when it was discovered that he had been a Ku Klux Klan member and things like that. But the story itself is fantastic. And it's just, you know, tremendous social commentary and a wonderful picture of American life earlier in the 20th century. And also Lawrence Vander Post, A Story Like the Wind, which especially if you're going to study Africa that year is very good. And also takes up issues, though they're all referred to in a very elusive way, but he's really talking about revolution and communism and colonialism. There are a lot of underpinnings in this story, but it's so beautiful because it's about a young man who is their age, and that's lovely. And then sometimes the students like to take up on their own A Far Off Place, which is the sequel in which the young man now has a girl, you know, who's also their age, who's accompanying him on this terrifying trek through Africa. But A Story Like the Wind is very, very powerful, very wonderful. And also that Jacques Lucerne story, not story, but autobiography, which is, of course, nonfiction, And There Was Light. And last but not least, Charles Dickens. Anything you could do with Charles Dickens. Our school traditionally did A Tale of Two Cities, of course, relating it to the French Revolution. But I can tell you that when I did that with my class in 1989, A Tale of Two Cities, with a little bit of prompting and coaching, my class could understand Dickens. When somebody suddenly appeared out of the blue who had been buried 5 or 10 chapters earlier, they knew exactly who it was. They could follow the plot, the characters. When I taught it again to my class in 1995, they had a very hard time with the plot. When I taught it again to my class in 2005, it was as though it was written in Swahili.
Wow.
They hardly understand the words, no less get the plot or the characters or anything. And these were all kids of equal intelligence. In fact, if anything, my most recent class was a far smarter, more awake, more brilliant group, absolutely, than any other group I had before. I definitely had grown stupider over the years, but they were much smarter. But they couldn't get it. They couldn't get it. So be careful with Dickens. You know, you can't assume, because he's great classic, and maybe you read him when you were their age and loved it, you may need to do a lot more explaining of what's going on in the book, and even give them like a, you know, plot outline or something, like a Cliff's Notes, along with their reading. But definitely, it would be a pity to neglect Dickens. Now, Steiner suggested that eighth graders should learn not A Tale of Two Cities, but A Christmas Carol. He felt that was the right story for eighth grade. Hmm. But of course, he was speaking about the English class in the German school. So he figured that by eighth graders in Germany should be able to read A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens, in English. Today, kids speaking English could hardly read Charles Dickens in English. Isn't that astonishing? And it
but
really
it might be, in some ways, you know, you wouldn't have to track the plot as carefully either, because they're already familiar with the story, most of them.
In those days, they weren't. I mean, there hadn't been about 20 movies made of it yet. It was still kind of a new story. You know, Dickens basically had only been around in the German language, about 40 years or so, 50 years. It would be a bit like reading Ernest Hemingway today or something. So he was still a modern writer. But anyway, some Dickens would definitely be very good for them. So those were the books that we work with. They also were reading on their own a lot of the you know, the sort of book lists books. There's a very good list of books called Make Way for Reading by Pam Fenner and Karen Rivers. They just brought out a new revised edition of it. And very good suggestions there. There's very little in there that, you know, isn't good. Some classes have already worked with The Hobbit, maybe in sixth or seventh grade. Others wait till eighth grade and do some Tolkien. So that would also certainly be fine.
Well, the movie is coming out.
Yeah. This is Chris. I just wanted to say I had my class do a Far Off Place, the Vanderpost, and the level of diction was really difficult. So I got enough copies so their parents could read it too. So each student was reading it with an adult so they wouldn't give up. And often they were coaching their parents on what they learned in class.
That is wonderful. That's a wonderful thing. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, now the thing about Lawrence Vanderpost that I was going to say was English was really his second language. He grew up speaking Afrikaans and then early on was being taught by his father who tutored him, as in the story. He was then learning English from his father. So Lawrence Vanderpost, he's very much like Joseph Conrad, who was Polish, and who also, for him, English was always his second language, and he struggled terribly, even though he's one of the great stylists of the English language. So that does come through a little bit, that, you know, he has to write sentences that go on for two pages or something, because he's not quite sure when an English speaker would stop. But that's a wonderful thing to get the parents involved in that way. That's great.
And we found that within any two pages of the book, we were connecting to 2 years of our education. It's so packed with references to everything from physics to geography.
Yes.
Just within two pages, we made a game out of it. Within every two pages, we could hit, you know, two grades that we had studied. So it's really remarkable.
That is wonderful. And, you know, an anthroposophist named Jonathan Stedall, who has just made a major film, 3-hour documentary about Rudolf Steiner, which is being shown all over the country in time. Jonathan Stedall, when he worked for BBC, got to be very close friends with Lawrence Vanderpost, and he did at least one documentary, I think maybe more, with Vanderpost. I wouldn't suggest that the children would watch this, but I think you could get hold of it on the BBC's archives. And it might be interesting to see Vanderpost in action, you know, talking about his work and his what he does. It might add a dimension to it if you want to work with him further with your class. But I'm glad you mentioned, you know, I think he's a very great resource. And you know, he also, Vanderpost, lectured frequently at Emerson College. He was very interested in Steiner's work, though he himself was a Jungian, who never, you know, he was never would have spoken of himself as an anthroposophist by any means, but he certainly expressed, you know, admiration and respect for what Steiner had done. And I think a little bit of that does live in his books. You know, there's clearly something more going on than is just going on in the physical world at any one time. Okay, so it's, everyone, it's 9:11 here on the East Coast. It may only be, 6:11 and wherever you are. But anybody, more questions? We'll take a couple more comments.
It's not a question, but, well, I would like you to send us something like a written list of these books you have spoken of, because I couldn't get precisely the names or how do you spell them.
I'd be happy to do that, definitely.
And if you have other suggestions as readers, I would be very grateful.
If I will look at my books, and if I see anything that I neglected to say tonight, I'll add that to that list.
Thank you.
And I'll also write the name and the publisher of that reading list book Make Way for Reading, which has some very good suggestions. And they have another set, another list for high school students, and some of those also may be appropriate for eighth graders. So I'll definitely do that, Margarita.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, the San Francisco Waldorf School, I understand, has a full-time librarian who has put out a list of books for the class teachers there that they give the list then to their students for summer reading, and that you can access it online through their website.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
They have a little blurb that they just want to give their librarian credit for, because she did all this work of putting all these book suggestions together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Other possibility of ideas.
Thank you very much. You know, and that's also something, once you all have one another's email, anything you come upon that's helpful, you're welcome to, you know, send it to each other, because, as I said, you're going to be the only eighth grade teacher in your school, maybe the only eighth grade teacher that's ever been in your school. And the more you can kind of help each other and, you know, give each other tips and successes and things like that, the better.
Yeah, thank you.
Eugene, I have a question for Teresa that might open a can of worms, so feel free to speak succinctly on it if you want.
The last question, it's like the last question at a parent evening, right?
I'm trying not to. So I'm at a public charter school in Portland, Oregon. And I'm in our school is located in a historically black neighborhood. And although we don't have a lot of racial and ethnic diversity at our school, people who come in from the private schools often comment on how we do. And I haven't heard you talk yet about teaching Civil War, slavery, civil rights, but I know it's something that I feel compelled to teach because of, you know, because it's part of the curriculum, but also specifically because of the neighborhood my school is located in and the demographics of that area. So I wonder if you can talk about how to teach that and how to do it sensitively.
Yeah, well, first of all, again, you know, the slide shows, I didn't want to give everything I had done, but on the CD, Elements of the Eighth Grade Curriculum, you will see a number of pages of things taken from the Civil War. And also writing about.
Can we order the CD from you?
That you can order from the millennialchild.com.
Okay.
And the go on, when you get there in the upper left-hand tab, it says online catalog. And just look for the elements of the Waldorf curriculum, and you'll see that. So there's more there. Yeah, I did, with two of my four eighth grades, the time was there, and it just seemed to be right. Even though Green Meadow traditionally has very few children of color, but certainly, you know, I wanted the kids to really experience this important stage in life. And also because I myself, as somebody who was in his 20s in the 1960s, had experienced the civil rights movement and, you know, had gone on marches and things like that, I also felt very comfortable talking about it. It wasn't just something abstract and historical. It was something really living for me. So definitely, I would do that. And as I said, this is where you have to be looking at your class, your geographical locale, your school, and, you know, maybe you do less about the dead white guys in the American Revolution, and much more about the Civil War. You know, the American Revolution, I mean, it's a wonderful story, but it is nothing compared to the French Revolution. It's almost like a chessboard, relatively speaking, though there's courage and there's war and there's brutality, but, you know, it left so little impression on the world. Whenever there's a revolutionary movement in the world, even if it's the Arab Spring or whatever, they're basing what they're doing on the French Revolution, not on the kind of political stuff of the American Revolution. So that could easily be cut short. And the Civil War, I think, is a much truer picture of our country. What happened in the Civil War is what we're living with now. Not, you know, as many would say, the Constitution and the Founding Fathers and so on. We're really, you know, we're still, the Civil War still hasn't really come to an end. That treaty meant very little. It's still raging powerfully. So definitely I would do more with that and take it up to the present. And, you know, especially, again, if you're going to be working this out with the election. And, you know, after Obama was elected, John McCain got up and gave a concession speech, which was the greatest speech McCain ever gave. And one of the greatest concession, the greatest concession speech anyone's ever given, in which he said, you know, it wasn't that long ago that a president was criticized for inviting an African-American person into the White House, you know, for inviting him to come as a guest. And look at how far we've come and how wonderful this is. So I would take it right up to that. I think that would be a very important thing to do.
Thank you.
So I don't think it's, I'm glad you brought that up. And as I said, you know, you can see by no means, I don't have every page we worked on, but you get an idea of how we took this up. All right. Do I dare to bid you all good night?
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. You're very, very welcome. And certainly, you know, be in touch with me. And if anywhere along the way you want to show me some student work that you send as an attachment in an email, I'll be happy to comment on it. Just be sure it's photographed well, you know. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. Good luck, everybody. Have a great year.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks
for the night. Very best wishes. I'll think of you all in September.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
Good night. Goodbye. Good night.